Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This is season 2, episode 6, and I am joined today for the very first time by Mark. Mark, how are we doing?
Fantastic, mate. Great to be here, making my debut, and well, I don't think I put a foot wrong there, right?
No, absolutely. It was absolutely amazing to have you, actually. You contributed really well to the session. I think people were really excited to have you and learn a little bit about your background as well, because you've got a very interesting background in data protection, being that you've come from the old information commissioner. So some people were very eager to sort of jump on that and have had some things to say in relation to that. But it was a GDPR radio session, as is every other week. But how did you find your first session, Mark?
I loved it, to be honest. I think I could get used to this. You know, you start as you mean to go on. Obviously, you made it very, very easy for me there. Obviously, you do this every week. I think, you know, you weave it together so naturally. So yeah, you know, couldn't have had a better person alongside me for the first one. And yeah, I think I've got another one coming up next month, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're very eager waiting for that one again. And thank you obviously very much for your kind words. It was a great session today, talking about all sorts of different things. We had a look at the Online Safety Act again. We know that's something that's become very prevalent as of recent. Also AI as standard. You know, I'm sure you're not surprised to hear that we're talking about AI again. Looking at what is considered personal data. It's actually a little bit of a layered discussion that we kind of drop in and out of during the course of the actual podcast. But I won't give too much away. We'll let you all jump right into the session, and we hope you enjoy.
Enjoy.
In the light of news in the space of data protection this week, is there anything that has caught your eye, Mark?
Well, one's just caught my eye very recently, actually. It was actually flagged up by John Baines, who obviously I know is a very good source of sort of knowledge and news within the DP space. And it concerns a Court of Appeal case between the Information Commissioner and DSG Retail, or you probably will know them as Currys, the electronics retailer. So this case essentially sort of gives us greater clarity on the definition of personal data. So back in 2020, DSG sustained a cyber attack whereby the attackers were able to get hold of the long card payment numbers and expiry dates. And the ICO fined DSG, and this was under the previous regime, the DPA 98, fined it the maximum amount of £500,000. And at the time, there was this argument made that, you know, potentially the attackers couldn't have identified the people from the data. But it was held that it remained personal data because DSG as the controller could obviously have linked it to other internal records. And this was something that DSG had challenged. They initially challenged it at the first tier tribunal, and the fine was actually halved to £250,000. But it didn't really deal with this kind of argument about whether or not it was personal data. And it ended up going to the upper tribunal, and they basically decide that, yeah, you know, an error was made in terms of not reaching that conclusion on the personal data aspect. And the ICO have gone and challenged it at the Court of Appeal. And basically, the ICO's decision has been upheld. You know, it's been concluded that the information is personal data if it falls within the statutory definition of the term, of course. And I think the key criteria with this case is that, whether or not the individual to whom the information relates is identifiable to the data controller. And of course, it's the data controller's responsibility to safeguard the data against any unauthorized or unlawful processing. And that's whether or not, you know, a bad actor will be able to identify the individuals to whom it relates. So again, I think the key takeaway, the key question is whether the data is personal data from the controller's perspective and not from the perspective of the third party. And of course, as I said, it does relate to the 98 Act, but again, those findings would carry on over to the current regime.
Yeah, it's a very interesting ruling, actually, and it sort of like leads me to maybe sort of like shifting my perspective on some elements of breaches as well, and the implication of that, because it doesn't seem like we're looking at it in the perspective of that sort of snapshot of what the bad actors may have hold of. But it's the broader scope of what the organization holds in general, and I think that kind of opens the floodgates for a lot of things to be considered maybe a little bit more risky from
from the offset, the shoot, if that's the approach that we need to consider to adopt. Because I was always kind of in half minds about cases like that. I'm always wary to say something does or doesn't identify someone. I think you can really get stuck in the pedantics of how far you're going in directly identifying someone. But I think that does probably quite substantially shift some of the onus of certain cyber attacks, but even more so on organizations. I think that's probably something that we need to look out for more. Because I imagine there's probably a few things that have been swept under the rug because the data isn't as identifiable, or it's not as risky because the data isn't identifiable from that perspective. But it's clear that very well may have not been the case for instances like that.
Certainly, yeah. No, I definitely agree. I mean, you can kind of see where the SG is coming from. Of course, they're hoping that, you know, there's some way that it wouldn't be classed as personal data, and then, you know, maybe they don't sort of suffer that fine and the sanctions and so on for the breach. But of course, yeah, you know, the emphasis is it's the controller's you know, sort of ability to identify the individual that matters, and then of course it's the controller their responsibility to safeguard that data, so they're not going to get off the hook necessarily. And I saw an interesting point made as well that this judgment in a way is very similar along the lines of the fact that, you know, pseudonymized data still be personal data.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's very similar, you know, along similar lines to that, which I thought was a good way of looking at it. But yeah, of course, it does just give us that greater perspective on, you know, the definition of personal data, I suppose.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there seems to be loads of case law at the moment that, or especially in the past couple of months, that has been floating around in terms of what we are considering personal data. I know there was discussions not that long ago around the anonymization of data and whether sort of data can be truly anonymized or truly pseudonymized, and how effective that actually is. So it's really interesting. And I think sometimes, as silly as it sounds, being able to identify or determine what personal data is a much more difficult task than you actually think it is, really. Especially when you get in the specifics of kind of rogue, not typical kind of data. It gets quite complicated, but no, it's really interesting, and it links to a statistic that I seen today actually whilst I was having a little peruse on the old LinkedIn, and I seen that allegedly having a Cyber Essentials certified business has led to 92% fewer insurance claims. This is sort of sparked off of some work that the NCSC. The National Cybersecurity Organization has basically been saying that there's a little bit of a stigma that cyber attacks only really impact the really big organizations, and that the big corporations are the targets, so to speak, of these cyber attacks. But it seems clear, apparently, to this individual's post that it also can affect SMEs as well, and is starting to affect SMEs. Based off some analysis that was undertaken last year, it seems that the scheme itself, the effectiveness of that scheme, has led organizations to have 92% fewer insurance claims than they would have done if they didn't have the certification, which I think is a really promising thing.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it definitely backs up the sort of value of that scheme, doesn't it? If it is that sort of beneficial and valuable to organisations, that it's going to reduce you know, the likelihood of them making insurance claims by that degree. So, yeah, I think it definitely backs that up. And yeah, I think it's a great point made, you know, that cyber attackers, they're not necessarily just looking at, you know, the big organisations that process lots of data. They're also looking for vulnerabilities as well, essentially, you know, and they will exploit them wherever they can be found, and that of course includes SMEs.
Well, that's probably where you're going to find the vulnerabilities, isn't it? You know, the large corporations is probably where you're going to do more damage, and I think we've seen in the, well, maybe not even so, but maybe to a broader scale in terms of publication, and if it's in essence to send a message, so to speak, then the bigger corporations tend to be the target of that. I know we was talking a little bit about, was it last week or the week before, where we were talking about shiny hunters and the cyber attacks that had been happening recently there as well. You know, people that are actively out there to either flip a profit or to make a statement. But SMEs are are just as a target, if not potentially more vulnerable, because they likely don't have the same kind of maturity in relation to cybersecurity that we would not even necessarily expect, but maybe what would be required. And it seems like having these kind of accreditations are really valuable. Now, I don't know if this stat exists because of part of the accreditation. I think you get access to some kind of free cyber insurance anywhere. I don't know how 100% accurate that is, but there are elements of having the accreditation that does link into Cyber Essentials as well. So that might be why there's been less insurance claims. But, you know, I think it's a fairly common sense position. You know, having these accreditations does give you a general sort of expectation of having your ducks in a row and being as secure as you can for a certain perspective. I know when we were talking about third parties last week that we were saying it's all well and good having these accreditations, but the emphasis is on being able to evidence that and really put your money where your mouth is. But, you know, as long as you're kind of maintaining that accreditation, I think it does speak volumes as well. And it's usually a real positive thing. So hopefully it's driving smaller organizations to take those accreditations a little bit more seriously as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I noticed in the chat as well, there's some mention there of course the CE or the CE Plus. So I believe that this sort of finding was just in relation to the CE scheme. But of course, yeah, thank you there, Tony, for mentioning, of course, that the CE Plus, that one is certified externally. And of course, the CE is self-certified. So again, yeah, I think it makes even more sense in that case, if it is self-certified, for organizations to go and get on board with that.
Yeah. And how important do you feel that Cyber Essentials is for organizations, Mark? I mean, from my perspective, I know it's always the case that it's one of the things that controllers in specific, when they're looking at vendor management, it's one of the things that obviously they shoot out to the most, and it's one of the things that they try to divert their eyes to the most. And they kind of make a little bit of a reflex decision based on whether they hold these accreditations or not, on sort of how tightly wound you are. You know, it seems to be something that's really crucial. I always kind of emphasize that it's one, not the be all and end all if you don't have it, and two, if you have it, it doesn't mean that you have everything and that you're absolutely incredible from a security perspective. A lot of it comes from what we actually hold internally and how we can manage and actively act on the great procedures that we'll have in place off the back of things like Cyber Essentials. So it's not the be all and end all, but it's important to emphasize its importance, so to speak.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think it's great from an accountability perspective, isn't it? It's kind of showing that, yeah, you've taken these steps to obviously bring yourself up to, you know, a good standard, essentially. But of course, particularly in the cyber landscape, you know, threats are always evolving, aren't they? So, you know, it's not a case that you can sort of rest on your laurels in a sense and think, oh, well, I'm certified, so I'm okay. I mean, the thing in the cyber landscape, I mean, I'm no expert in that area. I'm obviously from the DP side, but yeah, the threats are always evolving. And that means that the measures of safeguards that you have in place have to be obviously calibrated to these new threats. So definitely good from an accountability perspective, but by no means, it's not the be all and end all. And, you know, organizations have to, you know, continue putting the work in and can't rest on laurels, as you said.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a very key point, but still a great thing to have and something we definitely encourage if the business is up the appetite for it, especially for smaller businesses who maybe sort of come in and are in on those decisions as well. I also seen something else really interesting, and it's a bit of a sad story, really, in terms of what I've seen on the news this week, and it's in relation to removing a website or it's like a similar sort of like Reddit style kind of thing called Tattletale, following the suicide of a 16-year-old girl. So there's been a campaign recently that's been launched by Dr. Jessica Taylor, who's calling on Ofcom and the Information Commissioner, as well as the police and the government, to launch an investigation and to remove a website called Tattletale. That, I mean, effectively, from what I gain, I did go on there and I was having a little look at what it is. It's hard to tell, but it seems like a place to effectively just kind of be generally quite rude to people. It seems where we're talking about predominantly people who are in the public eye. It would talk about elements about their life. It would be predominantly critiquing them as well, and specifically aiming towards people like influencers and people who basically monetize, you know, their sort of everyday life. And it seemed to to release in a lot of sort of resentment from individuals on this website specifically. So it seems like from Jessica Taylor and her pleas, that a group of MPs are looking to remove the website from existing, and the Information Commissioner is obviously requesting that he can intervene in that as soon as possible. Apparently, there's an open response currently to the MPs confirming that there is an existing investigation into Tata Life, which I think is something, and it's the same thing. I thought I had a different name, due to Princess Dixon, who was the poor girl who committed suicide, who I believe was in some regard an influencer in some way. I'm not sure of the specifics of that, but I think in recent news, and when we're looking at things like the work that Ofcom's been doing and the Online Safety Act, there seems to be a load of really troubling information and websites that's out there that is really, really harmful to younger individuals and younger adults in this case. And it's clear that the Online Safety Act is something that is of real vital importance at the moment. When we're looking at things like the stuff with Grok AI at the moment, we had the cases of that poor boy who committed suicide due to the AI girlfriend as well. And there's a real emphasis on a need for some much stronger enhancements to the Online Safety Act, and maybe to the lengths that we go to remove harmful content like this, because it's clear that it's having a real detrimental impact as well to individuals.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'd never heard of this website either, but we had looked, didn't we, earlier, and it wasn't pleasant viewing at all.
No.
I definitely think, it's a positive thing that action is being taken in relation to this. And yeah, I'm not surprised at all that the ICO has received complaints about it either. Of course, the ICO did point out in its open letter to the MPs, of course, it can only focus on the data protection compliance side. Of course, any harassment and criminal sort of matters and so on will obviously have to be dealt with by the relevant authorities. But I think it's definitely one for the ICO to factor into the broader work and broader focus that it has had on obviously protecting children and young people online. And I saw there's been some more sort of updates on this from the government. So Keir Starmer's basically very recently announced a range of government measures to enhance online safety for children and sort of try and build on the sort of existing Online Safety Act provisions. So I think we're looking at amendments to the Children's Wellbeing in Schools Bill, which is aimed at strengthening protections around the collection of children's personal data. And there's also updates to the Crime and Policing Bill, aimed towards prohibiting AI tools from creating harmful or illegal content. And that, of course, includes the generation of sort of non-consensual sexual images. Mm. And there's also been updates from DSIT, Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, has announced measures to prevent the spread of these non-consensual explicit images, which again, I think a lot of that's coming from Grok, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Through X and so on. I think the government really, and DSIT in particular, is basically targeting measures we can have in place to ensure a permanent removal of these images from digital platforms. So one step that's been taken now is that such images are to be categorized as a priority offence under the Online Safety Act. So that puts such images, on a par with, material relating to child abuse or terrorism.
Mm.
And I think here comes the stick, is that tech companies are going to be required to remove the images within 48 hours of notification or face potential fines. And these could be sizable. They could be up to 10% of global turnover, or maybe also even the blocking of their services in the UK. And I believe the government is also looking at implementing a system basically whereby victims can report an image once and then have it taken down from multiple platforms, and then to also be automatically deleted if re-uploaded.
Interesting. That sounds really positive, actually. And I do feel quite positively about the changes being promoted. And I do feel like, some real care and attention's actually been brought in this direction. Maybe not too late, but maybe preferably early. I mean, I think at the moment the internet is really not a nice place to be at this point in time. And I think Charlotte makes an excellent point in how we actively try and deal with this as just as a nation, I suppose. And even removing sites is never really going to remove the issue, is it? You can we can put Grok behind the paywall, which I know was X's kind of laughable response to all of the issues at the moment, or you can turn websites down. It is pretty easy to get these things back and running, but
yes,
I think a real emphasis and I think a lot of the changes could help to sort of remedy that, in the fact that we have ways to link sort of images to even new up and coming websites or new posts to maybe work on the swiftness and sort of damage control, so to speak, because there's so much on the internet that is out of the hands of individuals.
Yeah,
and
it's
more about how we can effectively work to control those elements as quickly as we can, as and when they happen, because that's kind of the situation we've been led to be put in now. And I know at the moment that there's ongoing talks about things like Australia and the way that they sort of work with social media with young children. And I think it's the case where it's just banned, isn't it, to an extent, I think, to a certain age. I think a lot of access is just restricted. And I know that the government over in the UK has been trying to adopt similar approaches with social media. I think we're talking about things like social media curfews as well and stuff like that, and scrolling limits. I know that was something that's been discussed recently, and it's sad that it's had to get to this point really, but it really does emphasize the need for, and I've always been key for this whenever we talk about things like the Online Safety Act, and I know that Kate always sort of mirrors my thoughts on this, is that a lot of it comes from being able to support young individuals. When we had that session on the Online Safety Act in a podcast last year, a lot of the key points I was getting, we were trying to sort of discuss, is that I think from an ethical perspective of being there to have support networks for children and education on you know, how to identify these things, how to react to them, where they need to go to. I think a lot of people wouldn't even know how to react to situations like this as a young adult if they see stuff on things like Tattle Life, for example. And it's about knowing that they have further support in if they do feel ways that clearly the individual in this case has felt. And it's really sad. But I hope that the Online Safety Act and the measures that are going to span from it will maybe help in the purpose of educating and helping young individuals. But I'm pretty happy with the way the Online Safety Act is moving and the care that the Ofcom and the ICO seem to be giving it as of recent, because it seems to be in the news a lot. So I think that's a positive thing at the moment. At least these things are being brought to light rather than swept under the rug, so to speak.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Open Rights group has sort of criticised the government's approach. It's kind of said, you know, it's like we're playing whack-a-mole with online safety, essentially. I think there's been a comment made in the chat as well about how, yeah, you know, you kind of tackle an issue around a certain website, and then of course a very similar website can pop up again. And I think linked to this as well is kind of the issue of VPNs as well. Because of course, you know, if you do implement bans to certain websites and so on and prohibit access, you know, within a certain nation, of course, there's always the option now. And obviously young people are increasingly tech savvy, you know, they can jump on a VPN and obviously, you know, sort of change the location and then be able to access that website. And there was an interesting comment made by Big Brother Watch as well on this, you know, because I know the government has had plans as well to restrict access to VPNs for under 16s. And of course, that's going to entail sort of age assurance, you know, in order to stop sort of under 16s and young people from downloading VPNs. But of course, that in itself would kind of defeat the purpose of the VPN. Of course, the VPN exists to enhance privacy online. But of course, by sort of having to verify, you know, everyone that sort of downloads them, of course, it's kind of defeats the purpose. So I thought that was an interesting criticism. But I think, you know, we are kind of at a point of having to react to these things, aren't we? Obviously, unfortunately, things like this Grok AI are being used in the manner that they're being used to generate images and so on. You know, and now we're kind of having to react to that. I suppose what we want ideally is, you know, to prevent situations like this from happening in the first place. Of course, it does go back to your kind of privacy by design and default.
For sure.
And I think, you know, if we are going to get serious on this, then, you know, I think we need to inflate the importance of that and sort of try and move away from cultures where we think we can sort of react after the fact, you know.
Yeah, well, it's all about when do we make data and the digital footprint, so to speak, a bigger deal to the people that we're talking to, young children, you know, from the perspective of education or from a parental perspective or, you know, even as mentors or, you know, siblings, you know, when do we emphasize that you know, the place, social media, where young people spend most of their time, it is something that they really need to give a lot of care to, because realistically, these social media platforms aren't really built to protect the individual specifically. Probably more of the opposite, as it stands at the moment. And whilst I think we're making positive strides, I think it's really key that we have enough there to reinforce the importance of that to obviously young individuals that we know. And, you know, especially as you know, I know the educator's role is always sort of brought into these kind of elements, but there are other support networks that always exist for these kind of things. And I think it's important. It always will be important. And I understand that it's kind of a data protection matter, it's kind of not, but it is still equally just as important. It's still information that is out there, irrespective of whether it's for personal use and is someone just posting, you know, on things like TikTok and stuff like that. It can still be used in negative ways, and still being able to give individuals the knowledge to understand exactly what happens to their personal data, regardless of whether it's got to do with their work as something else, just them as an individual understanding what the ramifications of their personal information being where it is, is, I think, really important. And I think something that probably isn't spoken about enough. But I mean, I've also not been in school for a while, so it very well could be very different. It's maybe a conversation for some of my younger siblings, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, I'm even older than you, so yeah, I've no idea what sort of conversations are taking place now. But I think it takes me back to you know, sort of my sort of academic studies into privacy and data protection, and the fact that, you know, privacy has changed now, you know, in the modern age. You know, we are encouraged, you know, especially our generations and younger, to kind of share a lot about our personal lives, you know, as if that's kind of a normal thing.
Definitely.
So again, I think it kind of changes the assumption, you know. I think that's why it sort of highlights the importance of having the right to erasure under GDPR, because I suppose the assumption there, you know, in many cases is that, of course, the process and all the disclosure has already taken place. You know, because previously, in other areas of privacy law, such as like the misuse of private information tort, it was always more about kind of stopping the information from being disclosed in the first place. But of course, those remedies are kind of outdated now, when you know, the information is kind of everywhere online, isn't it? So
yeah, no, definitely, and that is a fantastic segue, I must say, into a recent report that the European Data Protection Board has published in relation to the right to erasure. Effectively, what it was saying under the EU GDPR, is that individuals are effectively struggling to be able to actively work and exercise the right to erasure as organizations, even though it's probably, I would say, the second most common used right over the right of access. Obviously, the right of access is very substantially number one, by far and away. But I think the right to erasure is somewhere in that race. It's probably not hot on its heels, but it definitely is behind it in some regard. And it seems like it's come down, based on this report, to a few key factors. The first one being a lack of internal procedures for handling requests. Now, this probably trickles down to all rights requests, and seems to be something that I don't see often, but when I do see it, it sort of highlights the importance of having a really good one in place. Is organizations that don't have SAR procedures or information rights procedures, and they just kind of just gung-ho it, you know, they go with the flow, they get one in, and then as soon as they get one in, it's like everybody's turned the lights off, and it's just chaos. People don't know what to do, people are worried about deadlines, they don't know how to acknowledge, they don't know when to stop the clock, they don't know who's actually even meant to be involved. And I think there's real strength that comes in having a very good, simple procedure. And again, I know we were speaking about this last week, but, you know, I think that is the forefront of your technical and organizational measures, especially in the regard of those organizational measures, of course. You can have the best technical measures in on the planet, but it's all about how, as an organization, you actually work, and you all know how to work, and you all understand it, you all read it, it's document controlled, you're reviewing it regularly, and it constantly fits the purpose of the business. The business is going to change a lot, the business might be acquired by another business, we might take on another service, it is going to impact the way things work. Maybe the data protection team gets bigger And we need to, you know, hopefully for some of your data protection team get bigger and your workload gets lessened. You know, I can only hope for you guys. And if that's the case, then we need to make sure that the procedure builds around that as well. And you know, it's one of those tasks, you know, you revisit it yearly and it's a very superficial sort of, oh, you know, the legislation hasn't updated. Maybe I'll just change this contact here and that's my review for the year. Happy days. But I think, you know, we need to be testing these things as often as we can. Even if we don't get a lot of SARs, test it. If you don't get a lot of portability requests, test it. There's such a value in being able to sample and test some of the stuff that you're getting and some of the, especially the rights that you don't really see. And in relation to a lot of GDPR related elements, is there's just such a value in getting some sampling and testing and building that into your procedure and how you work.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not just a case again of, I've produced this procedure and therefore I can sort of demonstrate my compliance. You know, does that actually work? Mm-hmm. I think as you pointed out there, Kane, I'm very well put, you know, you can have all the kind of state-of-the-art systems and so on, but is the bread and butter taken care of, you know, on an organizational level? Are staff aware of what a request looks like? You know, are they aware of who to send that to? And this can really make all the difference, can't it, in terms of whether you're achieving compliance or whether you're falling short.
No, definitely. And I think for me, maybe people find erasure a little bit harder because I think there's more of a legal sort of wiggle room, so to speak, in the fact that it's a qualified right. And there are, based on your justification for processing that data, reasons to hold and reasons not to hold onto it. You've got to also look at the maturity of your data retention practices and how good that is. You know, if it's the case where your retention maybe isn't as good as it should be, it's also going to be a little bit of a harder task, isn't it? And I appreciate that it's probably something that's difficult to deal with, in the same vein that SARs are difficult to deal with, you know. And I think the only reason that these are the two rights that people are talking about is because they're the only two rights that you often see exercised.
Yeah.
I don't think ever in 4 years I've seen anything about a data portability request, actually. Maybe I've mentioned it. Maybe I've mentioned it to someone on the phone and it's vaguely been mentioned, but I can't, definitely not more than a handful of times at the very least. But
yeah,
that could be my
same there, to be honest. Yeah, it's not something I've really come across too much. I know that it does have a lot of importance in areas such as like open banking and so on. So for example, you have these kind of payment and like account information apps where you can kind of get a breakdown of all your different bank accounts and so on. So I know that, you know, obviously data portability is very important to that because it's obviously one organization then sort of releasing your data directly, you know, to another organization kind of based on your consent. But yeah, I think day to day as DP practitioners, I think we will probably rarely see it, to be honest. I think, yeah, access to erasure definitely at the forefront. And maybe objections to direct marketing as well.
But yeah, of course.
Let's chuck that one in.
Withdrawal to consent, I guess, if we kind of count. And then obviously we're going to have the right to complain as well, which I'm sure will be a contender. In relation to your point, Charlotte, I did used to see a lot of requests in relation to deceased individuals. Like loads. I get it doesn't, I don't really see it as much now, but I guess obviously it doesn't fall under the realms of personal data. But when we're looking from the perspective of confidentiality and the need to keep certain confidential information, irrespective of obviously whether we consider it personal data or not, it's still really important. I think it's a good idea to have a process in place to respond for that. Are you in housing, Charlotte? Because that tends to be where I see a lot of the requests in relation to deceased individuals.
We're a police force. I'm from South Yorkshire Police.
Interesting. And are you getting these requests from individuals themselves? Just from data subjects about like.
Sorry,
like
say that again. My dog managed to get up and shake just as you were talking, and I couldn't hear.
No worries. Do you get any? Is it requests in relation to data subjects to like their next of kin and stuff like that, or information
your
relatives?
Yeah, it tends to be. And we just used to get like the very odd one, but we've seen an increase. So we wanted to make sure, obviously, that we were dealing with them consistently. We already had a process in HR, because quite often people will come and ask, you know, for their father's record when they were an officer in the 60s or something, you know, something like that, if we've still got anything. But we've seen an increase in people coming and asking about their son who's died or their sibling or, you know, or their grandfather or something like that. Sometimes they're trying to make sense of some sort of family situation that's been going on for a long time, or they thought something was going on and they want to find out whether it was true or not, you know, that kind of thing. And obviously they've got no legal right to that information at all. But you know, we want to do the right thing. If we feel that we can give it to them, then you know, then we will. And if we feel that it's not right, then we won't. But we've written a process basically. I just wondered whether other people had that same experience.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a really robust and good approach, is to have a process for that, especially even if it's something that you don't see very often. I mean, again, obviously we know under our laws in the UK that we won't consider it personal data. David's absolutely right in saying some jurisdictions do consider it to be personal data. But obviously when we're looking at the realms of the UK GDPR, that's not the case. So it's looking at, as well as, you know, it's not personal data, but still trying to look to see if, not to apply the principles, but kind of taking it into account. Obviously we want to help these individuals as best we can.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like you are kind of treating it like personal data, but you're not at the same time. It's a weird kind of line, isn't it? But I completely get your approach in it. And you know, you want to help the individuals, but you also appreciate that there's instances where a line has to be drawn. But no, really, 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 really good comment. I'm always intrigued about deceased individuals in that regard, and the questions that we get around them. It's not something I've actually seen in a while, but maybe it's because we've advised enough of our customers on it that maybe it's a question that doesn't need to be asked anymore. But I'm very, very, very aware that we are sort of tailing off towards the end of the session. Are there any sort of closing thoughts for you, Mark, in relation to any of the news or anything that you would like to share?
I think there's just the one last story which I thought worth a mention. It was about Meta looking to integrate facial recognition technology into the smart glasses that it sells. I mean, I must admit, I wasn't even really aware of smart glasses, but apparently they sold over 7 million.
I've seen them talking about.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously very, very futuristic, isn't it? But I think for me, you know, from a DP perspective, I can't see how it's feasible, certainly not under our sort of DP regime. And to be honest, I think my opinion on that would be it's technology going too far, basically.
Oh, for sure. It's a bit Tony Stark-esque, isn't it? And I have seen these cracking about the glasses. I know they had the Ray-Ban ones at some point, and there were discussions at that point to actually try and implement AI into those, and I think those kind of slowly disappeared. But it's meant to identify people from the glasses, isn't it? Is that right? It's meant to tie like a name to this
individual.
Absolutely terrifying. You know, being able to identify, this person based on basically their features and what AI has come to. And it's a very similar case from what we've seen currently about the police and their sort of desire to implement facial recognition software all over the UK in public spaces to identify, obviously, individuals of interest. It's really worrying, and I think something that's going to be very hard to apply in practice.
Well, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, it's one thing for the police to be looking at this sort of technology, and probably another thing for kind of ordinary citizens walking around day to day, you know, sort of having the facility to do that. And then, of course, it raises the question of what's happening with the data. You know, massive red flags around that for me. I'm surprised it's being brought back up. I know, like you say, it was something that was kind of binned off previously, wasn't it? But it's a concern.
No, definitely. And, you know, if everyone's going to be walking around with, you know, with their aviators on, looking like Tom Cruise, being able to tell who is who and what is what, you know, it's a very stark view of the future. It doesn't all feel quite real to me yet. But I don't think it'll get that far. I feel like you see a lot of these things floated about, and I never feel like they just get past that first kind of gate.
Surely not. I mean, yeah, it's like it should be confined to an episode of Black Mirror.
100%,
something, shouldn't 100%. It? You know, it shouldn't be brought into real life.
Charlotte says it's very Wally-esque. I can see that. I can see that. We're all just going to be in big chairs, sort of floating about, not having to lift a thing. I could see that. But it's very probably a great film as well, I must admit. But I believe that is all that we have in store for today. We'd like to thank you all very much for coming. Thank you very much, Mark, for joining us as well. It's fantastic to have you.
Brilliant to be here and on board.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to next episode as well. So make sure you tune into next episode because we have a very special guest for next week where we'll be talking all, a little bit more about AI and a little bit more about SaaS. We'll be joined by Catherine Brooks. So please, if you can make that session next week, please do, because we think it is going to be a bit of a doozy. But everybody enjoy your weekend and hopefully we will see you next week.